Hey guys, this is Mike Mahaffey, the old bastard BJJ guy, here for BJJ Metal Models. Back in my day, we had to walk uphill in the snow both ways to get to the academy just to learn some crappy technique from a random purple belt. You kids have it so easy, because now you can just subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium and get tons of great audio courses to learn new techniques, enhance your mindset, and entertain yourself. You can even get personalized rolling reviews from some of your favorite BJJ Metal Models coaches, including me. It's like having your own seminar, you spoiled little whippersnappers. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium right now, get off my lawn, and go train.
Hey, welcome to BJJ Mental Models, episode 265. I'm Steve Kwan. BJJ Mental Models is your guide to a conceptual and intelligent jiu-jitsu approach. And today I am back with another returning champion, Ms. Erin Hurley. Erin, how's it going? It's been a while.
It has been a while. It's great. It's great to be back on here and get nerdy with you.
Let's get nerdy. Now, it's been a while since you've been on. I think probably a lot of people do know you, but just in case, why don't you give yourself a quick intro? Tell us the TLDR here for your life story.
Okay. I am a mental performance consultant. I recently graduated with a master's degree in sport and performance psychology, but prior to that, I earned my black belt under Hubens Charles Colbrina. I spent a decade, pretty much all of my 20s, competing around the world at the top level. And, you know, living the life, I worked for some major jiu-jitsu magazines as a journalist and a photographer. I covered a lot of events. I've trained at a lot of different places. I've traveled a lot and taught a lot of seminars. And now my focus is on helping people with their performance anxiety.
Now, let's talk about that a little bit. You've been very, very heavily involved in the mental health scene and mental well-being scene in jiu-jitsu for quite a while. People probably would recognize your name as being the founder of Submit the Stigma. Tell me a little bit about what this initiative looks like to you and what you mean when you talk about mental coaching. I hear people all the time talking about how they need a mental coach in jiu-jitsu, but it just seems like such a big, giant field and big, giant topic. So I'd love to better understand exactly how you fit into that puzzle.
Yeah. So I am not certified mental performance consultant because I'm actually working on that. So the Association of Applied Sports Psychology, they have the certification. They hold all of that regulation and ethics. And I'm one of those people that wants to do it the proper way. So there are a lot of mental coaches out there that just learn from one person that says, hey, I'm a mental coach and I can teach you how to be a mental coach. And it's this very basic program. I don't really know what they entail. I just know that they are definitely not as rigorous as a grad school program. And a lot of the inner work that needs to be done for someone to become a mental coach to help others hasn't been done. So it's a lot of unregulation, actually. So I'm choosing to go the most regulated route without becoming a psychologist or a therapist or a counselor, which are protected terms. So there is no state licensing. I didn't want to be held down by a licensure that was only for one state or if I am in Canada and I want to work in Canada. They recognize the CMPC, which is the Certified Mental Performance Consultant. So I have a mentor. We're figuring out, you know, just the end stuff that I need to do to get certified. But what I do now is I work with people who are mentally stable. And what I mean by that is someone who has mental health issues would need to go to a clinical psychologist or a therapist or mental health professional because their quality of life is at risk. So for mine, I deal with the performance route. It's not to say that I don't care what goes on in someone's life. I absolutely do because we don't live in a vacuum. Your performance is always going to be affected by your life. And I take a very human first, athlete second approach, which I have research that says this is the way for, you know, sustainability and longevity and enjoyment. And so I try to help athletes, and I have had success, work through their fears, their limitations, their mental blocks, whatever you want to call them, by working on mental skills. And mental skills training is self-talk, imagery, learning how to maintain focus, where to put your focus. It's managing your activation and your nerves and your arousal. It's the way that you interpret the things that happen to your body when you get nervous. And it's self-belief, it's confidence, it's self-efficacy. So all of these qualities that are required to go into a jiu-jitsu match, or I even have a surfer, and, you know, to go out there on her longboard and perform as well as she does, it requires a lot of qualities and traits. And the biggest thing is that most of these traits that people think are just inborn, or you just are or you aren't, can be improved, can be increased, can be developed. And that's a big thing that was really awesome for me when I was going into this route, because I knew that I could help people, but there's a lot of rhetoric about, well, you're either tough or you're not, or, you know, you can't teach hard. I was sponsored by Hyperfly for a number of years, and I was spitting that out every chance I could on social media. And now I'm like, I don't know if I believe that. I really think you can. So I try to help people bring their best out of themselves. And eventually I become obsolete. I help people self-regulate. I help them kind of check in with themselves, reflect, have introspection. And then I just guide them and facilitate them. So it's a really long journey or short journey. I've worked with people just a couple times and they've had, you know, a lot of success from it. But it's relationship-based and it's a lot of we and not I or you. And I love it.
I love that you've carved out a very specific definition for where you work within. I think that kind of helps people understand the lay of the land and where people like you can help out and when they would need to go to someone else.
Exactly.
You talked about mental health and quality of life and how you help people with performance, but there's also a tier of people where their mental health situation is such that it is impacting their life in a very negative way, and they might need to go in and get extra help. And I'm assuming at that point, you're talking about things like severe depression and such. What exactly is the dividing line there? Like, if someone is coming to you, obviously, they're looking for a performance hack. They're looking for ways to be better at jiu-jitsu and to be tougher and more resilient mentally. But for people who maybe need more clinical help, what's the dividing line where you would say to people, actually, you don't want to go to me. You want to go to this other person instead?
Yeah, that's the interesting part. And a lot of my clients actually do work with therapists or psychologists or even a psychiatrist because they are prescribed medication. So they work alongside. And you know, it would be great if I was on some interdisciplinary team that I could work with that exact therapist, but it's not really on that level. It's just this person hires me and they hire this other person and we both work on things. And whatever that client wants to tell me about their sessions with therapy, you know, if there's an overlap or if there's maybe some difference in the approach, that might come up. But essentially, if I feel that my work is either going to harm or not help, then it's when I would refer someone to clinical. So if they're dealing with a lot of trauma, which I am trauma informed to the sense of I do understand that the experiences that you go through will affect your future performances and the beliefs about yourself. So I do love to unravel those. But if it has nothing to do with sport, it's very hard for me to be competent. And that's ethically, I need to refer when I'm not competent to deal with that. And so while I have taken a course in diagnostics, I'm not legally allowed to diagnose. And so while I could take a diagnosis and maybe get more understanding, I cannot guide my coaching by that diagnosis and I don't use, you know, the DSM. And so knowing that this person might fit the bill for a certain type of mental health disorder or issue, that's when I would refer. And it's not to say that I can't work with them anymore. It's just that I do think that you need more than I can give.
Yeah, makes a ton of sense. I love that you're open and honest and transparent about your boundaries in a sport where every black belt seems to be an expert in all fields of science and finance and geopolitics. You know, it's nice to have someone who just says, hey, this is outside of my core competency.
Yes, yes. People will relate that to humility. But really, it's just ethics. And the first class I ever took in my grad school program was ethics. And that was like, wow, my mind was blown in terms of how things should happen and should be run and how people should be treated and what harm looks like. And harm can be not intentional. And so you really have to be self-aware. And that's just not what jiu-jitsu people are or have unless they are in domain where that is a standard held upon them by another domain, like their job or something where they volunteer or they've learned somewhere about ethics. But jiu-jitsu does not have much, and it's basically up to each specific gym to decide their culture and how ethical they want to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know about you, Aaron, but I have been told many, many times that jujitsu is a guaranteed way to make you humble. It's guaranteed, right? Doing jujitsu will humble you. No one in jujitsu has an ego. That's at least what I was told to start this out, you know?
Yes. Yes. I have no ego whatsoever. I don't care what happens to me. I don't ever want to win.
It's funny. Someone once said to me, I have no ego. And I thought, that is the most egotistical thing to say,
yes,
is that I have no ego. If you are building your whole identity around the fact that you have no ego, I think that means you have an ego by definition. But anyway,
yes,
tell me a little bit about how someone would work with you and what type of person as well. Are you dealing with only exclusively high-level pros or hobbyists and casual grapplers or some mix of the two?
A majority of my clients don't even compete that often. I have black belts who wanted to re-enter competition after having time off or just to take it up a notch to the next level. I have a bunch of white belts. I have people who simply just want better decision-making models. I have people, it's funny how many of my clients have already been listening to BJJ Mental Models and how much these episodes have helped them in discovering their mindset prior to working with me. They reference it all the time. Oh, Robert Aki or, you know, Zinzer and all these existing episodes out there. And what's interesting is that everyone can have a goal, and what that goal entails is very personalized, and what you define as success is personalized and customized as well. So I kind of help someone map out what their goals are and how they want to achieve them while also increasing certain traits or qualities that would benefit them. And oftentimes it does benefit them in other domains and life, even though that's not my domain. But it's important that they understand the overlap and to be explicitly told, hey, this actually works for your clientele that you work with. I mean, I have people who are not confident at all in jujitsu despite being a black belt, and yet they work for these major, major companies and have really, really important jobs that they excel at and feel so good at. And so those qualities don't necessarily come through into jujitsu until you kind of go, hey, I think you do hold that quality. It's just not necessarily on the mat. And so I blend that. And when people work with me, I really pay attention to what they think and feel about themselves and the relationship they have themselves. My mentor likes to call it helping someone come home to themselves, because the answers really are within. I use motivational interviewing to try to get the answers out of someone rather than giving my advice. And of course, some people who, you know, have followed me for a while or know that, you know, good at jiu-jitsu or have taught jiu-jitsu, they might ask those questions. And I sometimes go into that, but I definitely work on trying to just be a mental coach when I'm hired as a mental coach and staying within my bounds. So working with someone just looks like an hour conversation every week or every other week or every 3 weeks, and developing the different skills and doing different homework and collecting data. So the data that they bring back to me gives me insight into what's going on in their head. And then we move forward based on that using evidence-based theories and models in the research.
Got it. And you touched on something that I think is worth really digging into a little bit deeper. The fact that so many of the people who benefit from a service like this are hobbyists, they're non-pros. People, when they hear about a mental coach or a performance coach, the thought always goes to, well, this must be some high-level competitor who does this professionally. And it's absolutely true that high-level pros have and need this level of support. I know so many people who compete at high levels and they have different mental struggles, whether it be confidence or anxiety or motivation or resilience. That's part of the game. But I don't think enough people think of this as something that casual grapplers can benefit from too. And, you know, you talked about some of the episodes we've done in the past on related topics. Something that comes up a lot when I get feedback from listeners, a lot of the time the people who are struggling with confidence the most, they're casual people. And it probably never occurred to them to seek out a service like what you offer because they don't think of themselves as professionals. Whereas in reality, they're probably the prime audience for this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Hobbyists, casual grapplers, they beat themselves up so bad about, I'm just not good enough. And I think part of that is just comparison, you know, looking at the people who train 6 hours a day every day and do this professionally and just feel bad because you're not as good as them. I think that gets to a lot of people, that unfortunate comparison that people make. And I think hobbyists of all people would really stand to benefit from a service like what you're talking about.
Absolutely. And what you're talking about is the motivational orientation and what people are motivated by. and also where you are using, what standard you're judging your progress and performance by. And so in the research, we have a task orientation and we have an ego orientation. And ego deals with comparison, and I am better than this person. And in jujitsu, it's very, very easy to do so because it's a dichotic relationship. If someone is playing guard, the other is generally the passer, and vice versa. If someone loses, the other person wins, and vice versa. So it's very much black or white, and people get into that type of thinking. That's where that, you know, no ego or only humble or, you know, work hard, no one cares. And this hardcore type of mentality comes in. And also the hierarchy, you know, unless you're training in a no-gi gym that doesn't require ranked rash guards, that rank is in your face. And there are different journeys and the way that people get promoted, where like one person might get promoted faster than the other. And those are just really normal questions to ask. Like, why not me? What am I doing wrong? Why is my progress not happening as fast as others? And so there's a lot of loopholes into having just an ego-oriented mindset. So the task orientation is more about mastery and how well I'm doing something. And it's self-reference. So say I go with you and we train and you sweep me 3 times. And then I come back and now I've defended 2 of those sweeps, maybe like a week later after I've kind of figured you out or whatever. And so then I can have a self-referenced way of judging my progress and saying that regardless of what someone else was doing, whether they had a good day or a bad day, whether they ate something really fueling or not, all of that, I think it really gives you a standard that you can cling to that is believable and realistic. And so if I can do a task better, if I can execute an action or a technique or a series of actions or techniques, then that tells me that I am getting better. And so a lot of people don't have these standards that they can judge themselves by because they don't have someone who's telling them, hey, why don't you look at that last training session, take what you can from it, and then see if you've actually changed. And so there's no data being recorded. So how do you know if you are getting better? Then if the only way that you're able to tell is by winning tournaments or by submitting people in training and not getting submitted or by getting your next belt or stripe, that obviously will curate a more ego orientation because it's the only means of knowing your progress. And it also puts a lot of stress on a coach who has multiple students to be that person who's in charge of your progress. Because on one side, I'm like, yeah, every coach should be in a position where if their student were to come up to them and say, how far am I from my next belt? And what do you think I should be working on? Or how do you think I'm doing? And getting almost like a full report. But I know that's not always possible simply because we have so many people in the classes at once and these gyms get really big and the attention kind of gets spread thin. So yes, you should have a coach that is able to tell you your progress. But if you can't be self-motivated and self-monitoring your own progress, you're going to get lost in the sauce. And you're going to get unmotivated, or you're going to hit that plateau or those blue belt blues and you might quit and never come back.
That's a great point. I think a challenge a lot of people have is they come into this with the mindset that the coach is going to give them everything they need. Mm-hmm. And it becomes very much a kind of a one-way learning relationship where they just expect the coach to set up everything for them, set up all the pins so you can knock them down. But you bring up a good point. I mean, even in a small gym, that coach might be coaching 20 people at the same time in a class. And as gyms get bigger, you could have hundreds or more students on your roster at any given time. And no matter how much the coach cares, it just isn't reasonable to expect that that coach is going to be able to give you the kind of detailed one-on-one attention that they can give to, you know, that they're giving to everyone, because that's just not possible. A coach cannot divide their attention that way and be that attentive to hundreds of people at the same time. And so part of what needs to happen then is people need to take some ownership of their own journey and fill in the holes that they're not getting from their coach. Understand that your coach is not the only person who can help you. You know, with high level athletes, they often have a team. They will have a mental performance coach. They might have a diet prep person. They have, they'll have their own physio. All of that stuff becomes very important because one coach is not going to be good enough. And this is something I've heard a lot of more of the old school guys talk about in jujitsu, just that there seems to be a mentality shift now where students expect that they get everything they need from their one coach. Whereas back in the day, they will often say, people were expected to take more ownership and go out and figure some things out on their own. I think some of that is coming back in terms of things like reverse classroom, So there's ways that that is being introduced to the actual teaching. But you bring up a good point about mental toughness. It's going to be helpful to many people if they go out and find this service themselves, because a coach just reasonably cannot do a good job providing that level of attention to their entire roster. And moreover, like you mentioned earlier, they're probably not qualified anyway, even if they wanted to.
Yes, the qualification is huge. And it's sad kind of that you have to be like, well, look, you're pretty ethical. You understand your own boundaries of competence. And so many people don't. But it's also hard not to get caught up in it. I have a thing about being called professor. I do not have my own school. I've been a black belt since 2017. I've taught many seminars. I even teach classes at my husband's gym here in Niagara Falls, but I am not necessarily anyone's professor. And I've been to gyms where I've been standing off on the side, not even training in my civilian or mortal clothes. And they come up and they're like, oh, it's professor. Oh, hey, professor. Almost like they're putting me on a pedestal and gives me the opportunity to take advantage for sure. But would I know? Because I'm a good human. But I mean, people who see the opportunity and kind of start feeling like maybe they haven't ever felt that way before, they've never had someone look up to them. And if all they had to do, which it's not simple, but get a black belt, then all of a sudden they are, you know, certified or qualified to give life advice, to give advice about, like you said, finances and life skills and whatnot. And so it's my job also. I went into this thinking, I want to work with athletes, but I want to work with coaches more because that's obviously more of an impact. And a lot of the athletes or students do not have much autonomy, especially if they're a lower belt. Who are they to come in and say, you know what? I think we should do more task-based games. I think I'd learn a lot better if you did that. You can't exactly go up to these longtime black belts and they're just going to be like, oh, yes, you know everything. So it's really hard to say that coaches should have these qualifications, but they certainly can. And I think that the whole community would surely benefit from some sort of certification that would say, hey, I am safe space, or I am trauma-informed, or I do understand how to motivate people without breaking their spirit. Those aspects. And I've been in a lot of toxic situations in my own experiences. And so when I go back to those experiences that I had of overtraining and not having a lot of competence and sense of confidence in what I do based on not getting praise or affirmations, I surely know that I would have gotten better faster, or I would have had more success, or I would have enjoyed it more. But unfortunately, as you say, back in the day, it was more about struggle than it was anything else. Like if you're not struggling, then you're not training hard enough. If you're laughing, you're not going to win your next tournament. If you are not training and take a day off, your opponent's training more than you. All of these things that tell you I'm not doing enough, that comes from coaches. It's much like abuse cycle of trauma and handing it down to psych of generations. It's just, well, this is how my professor taught me. Therefore, this is how I will teach, and this is how I will run my gym, without kind of doing any of their own research or understanding of what humans need in order to learn. And so I do hope to have more information out there for people to understand what it would be to help their own athletes foster motivation, foster commitment and mental toughness.
Yeah. Yeah. Now let's talk about how we define mental toughness, because you bring up a good point. A lot of the way that people promote mental toughness in the sport of jiu-jitsu, it's kind of a bit of a joke. And actually, it's a joke that we've made fun of. I mean, this year, we did an April Fool's Day episode with Rob Bernacki, specifically lampooning the way that people in the jiu-jitsu sport try to sell the idea of being tough and alpha and all of this stuff. I mean, I have seen so many like inspirational memes with lion pictures and so many Marcus Aurelius quotes on my social, and people do get value out of that. I don't want to say that these are bad, but it's a very one-dimensional approach to toughness. And I think that toughness goes much beyond that. I mean, vulnerability is a very important form of toughness, right? Being self-critical, transparent. There's more to toughness than just being this chiseled piece of granite that doesn't feel anything. And like you said, I mean, if you look back at the way that jiu-jitsu used to be, do we really want to be like those people, or do we want to be better than that? And this is where I would ask you, what does the practice look like? If I were to sign up with you today and we were to sit down and you were to help me be more mentally tough, and believe me, I need it, what would that look like? How would you help me, and what should I expect from a process like this?
What's interesting is that even in the research, there is no agreed upon definition of mental toughness. And even in my program, one of our assignments was, why don't you define mental toughness? And what does it look like? And how would you notice it in someone? How do you know if you are mentally tough? And while there are assessments, they're also based off of their own definition. So you kind of have to decide what definition you want to use. And so back in 2011, I believe it was, two researchers, Sandy Gordon and Daniel Bucciardi, they developed one that actually has about 7 parts to it. And that is that you have to believe in yourself and your abilities. It means effectively managing your attentional focus, persevering through tough times, which is often the only definition that gets attached to mental toughness, desiring success, expecting positive outcomes, effectively managing emotions, and understanding the sport context. And many would use words like grit or resilience, but what they don't understand is that just simply being tough doesn't mean a facade. It means the things that are going on inside. And the facade, there is no facade. It's taking things as they come, being adaptable and flexible, being able to say, whatever comes my way, I will be able to deal with it. I may not know what's going to happen, but I am going to have confidence in my skills that I will know what to do and how to do it when the time comes.
I agree with you completely. I think when people hear about mental toughness, a lot of the time they think that just means suck it up, stiff upper lip, move on. But that by itself isn't really a great definition of toughness because it's not a smart definition. You can be in an abusive relationship with someone who is ruining your life. In that situation, do you really want to adhere to that definition of toughness? Do you really want to just suck it up? I mean, just enduring is not a sufficient definition of toughness because you can endure a lot of things, but it doesn't help you get out of that situation or improve. So I like this multidimensional definition that you've provided here. That makes quite a bit of sense.
Yes. And it's interesting because most people who would consider themselves mentally tough, if they were to take one of the assessments, they might realize that their definition is a lot different than the real definition. And I recently created a mental toughness quiz that is actually the same questions from the Sport Mental Toughness Questionnaire developed in 2009, but it was just geared a little bit more towards the audience, let's say, jiu-jitsu and I guess non-really academic, really easy questions to answer. There's Likert scale from strongly disagree to strongly agree. And so I put in all of that and I've gotten some data. And it's really, really interesting because I can't define why it is that this is the way, but there's only been, let's see how many entries. There's only been about 30 or so entries. So there's been black belts, purple belts, brown belts, blue belts, white belts, all of those. The highest scores were the white belts. The lowest scores were brown belts, and in the middle was black and purple, and second highest is actually blue belt. And I don't know if it's safe to judge someone simply by their belt level, but that's the kind of data that I've decided to put together. And what's interesting is I think because it's self-reported that white belts haven't actually dealt with the plateaus and the issues of maybe competition, feeling not good enough and being frustrated. So I don't think that they experience those, while someone who is more seasoned, like a brown or black belt, may have a more realistic view. But some of the varying answers are, I get distracted. Some people put strongly agree. Some people put strongly disagree. So I found that concentration, attention, and focus are a big aspect that people are struggling with, or they're like, nope, I don't need any help at all. The other is worrying about performing poorly. And, you know, that goes into some more information in terms of fear of failure. There's actually a new research article that came out. I just got it. I haven't really been able to look at it, but it's the downward spiral of the fear of failure in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And it was put out, I think, last month. So it's really new and fresh. And so it just says that people are afraid of their worth and kind of having this idea of what their worth is and then competing and have it be different. Oh my God, I suck more than I thought I did. And then also disappointing important others like your coaches or your teammates. That is a huge one. Or just the simple fear of embarrassment, of putting out effort and then not having it produce the desired outcomes. And then thinking, wow, I looked like an idiot for even trying. And so mental toughness, would be able to mediate a lot of those feelings. Mental toughness deals with attention, but a lot of it is managing those emotions and your arousal. And that's something that many people don't know what to do about. Some of the risks involved, actually, that I wanted to bring up too is perfectionism, because as you said, being self-critical, which is important, but too much. And now you're putting yourself in a situation where you just can never win in your eyes. And now you're berating yourself. And now you need self-compassion in order to combat that. And also the mental health risk of being too tough to ask for help. I think that's one of the scariest ones, that you can be in a situation where you feel like, nope, if I were to ask for help, even if it means asking for help on my De La Hiva sweeps, oh, that might insinuate that I don't know enough and that I'm not good enough. And that's vulnerability, like you were saying. So there's a lot of caveats to being mentally tough. And one of them that I hate is that banner that I've seen in some gyms that says, no one cares, work harder. That's not the way. That's not the way to get someone to put more effort in. To put more effort in, you must reward effort. So telling someone that no one cares is the opposite.
Yeah. Now, I understand, of course, that you're working with a small data set there, but what you described tracks with my personal experience. When I was a white belt, there were no expectations on me. I was just a white belt. No one expected me to go in and be good. And so every day was just a ton of fun. If I'm to kind of reflect on my whole jiu-jitsu journey, white belt was the most fun part of the whole thing. Sometimes I kind of wish I could go back to that. And you talked about the dissatisfaction of being a brown belt. If I had to guess, I would say that is because when you are second from the top in terms of the ranking at your gym, there's a lot of pressure that people put on themselves. They really put that black belt up on a pedestal and they often feel very unworthy. And then, of course, there's also just the situation of, you know, sometimes when you're a brown belt, look, it happens. You roll into the gym and some blue belt like beats you up or taps you out. And at that point, when you're far enough up the ladder and that black belt is looming, that can really just wreak havoc on your ego. It can make you feel like dog shit when that happens. That's not so much the case when you're a white belt because, look, everyone expects you to be bad. That's part of it. At brown belt, though, it's a totally different story. We put all of these expectations on people that the belt is some sort of magic indication of who's going to beat who. Like every brown belt in the world should be able to beat every purple belt. I hear coaches say this all the time that, you know, well, if you're a brown belt, that means you should be able to beat every single purple belt that comes in. That is ableist garbage, right? I mean, I'm sorry, but if you are a 60-year-old hobbyist brown belt, you should not be expecting that some 20-year-old roid monkey blue belt wrestler is going to just be chewed up by you, right? That isn't going to happen. And I think that we need to demystify the belts and understand that, look, these are not an indication of worth and we shouldn't look at them as that way. I don't even think we should look at belts necessarily as an indication of merit. I think we put way too much faith and too much importance on the belts. And again, yeah, what you're saying, like I said, it tracks, man. I mean, white belt, I was a lot happier back then. And a big part of that was mindset. It's just because I didn't have any preconceived notions that I should be good. I gave myself permission to go in there and fail and to have fun. And as that starts to wash away and you get more and more experienced and your ego gets involved because you have expectations about your performance, that's where the misery comes in for a lot of people.
Yes. I think permission to fail is a great way to have someone break through that mental block of, oh, I couldn't dare lose to this person. And if they were, I'm definitely going to walk them through the submission that they're getting on me, or I'm just going to give it to them, or I'm going to get angry. There's been times where I had expectations as a purple belt, which is a fine example. I was rolling with someone and we got our purple belts at the same time. He ended up getting his black belt way before me, and he just was going up the ranks really fast. He was also a previous professional athlete. So there's a lot to say about that. And he was a little bit older. And I remember he passed my guard in training. I just kind of gave up and I said, just fucking submit me. Just submit me already. You're just, yeah, get to my back. What? That's what you want, right? And I start being this total brat. And he's like, Aaron, it doesn't end there. It doesn't stop here. You have to keep going. And at the time, I thought it was okay because it showed how committed I was and the high standards that I was placing on myself to say, if I get my guard passed, that means my guard sucks. And I need to be better. And I would shut down out of frustration and almost self-disappointment. And what really mental toughness would have looked like is to say, this sucks that I got my guard passed. I feel like I should have done better. And I'm going to still try. The round isn't over. I can still get those points back. I can still submit. There is still a way for me to win here. I can't count myself out. And that goes back to that definition of not only desiring success, but expecting positive outcomes. And expecting positive outcomes is not a desired positive outcome, because that can change. The goalpost can actually change. So let's say you go into a training session and you're like, I'm not going to let anyone pass my guard. Well, now you've given yourself this expectation that really may not be important, because now instead of opening up your game and thinking about how you can explore and try things and expand your game, now you're just playing this tight game of I just can't lose. And when you come from a place that says, just don't do that, just don't do this, it makes you focus more on not doing that. And so now you don't have a definition or an approach of what you're trying to do. Now you're just saying, as long as I don't do that, anything but that. So when I was competing, I was scared of stand-up. I tried takedowns when I was, I call it younger. I was younger, but as a white belt, and I would just pull people on top of me and I got really embarrassed. And I said, I'm never doing that again. But even at black belt, I would just pull because I was avoiding takedowns. So it wasn't a smart pull. It wasn't an intellectual decision of when and how I would pull. I would just grab something and sit. And a few times, I posted this on my story recently, I can laugh at it now, but I pulled and the other black belt, we were in the absolute, it was in Brazil, and she got mount. I basically just dove under her mount, shook my back, all that. And it was horrible because I simply was just avoiding the stand up or the takedowns. And I wasn't making intelligent decisions. So all of that is to say that if you don't know what your outcomes or expectations are, and having them being, you know, realistic and self-appointed, then you're going to have a long, long, long journey of frustration and feeling that you are not hitting the mark and that you're not progressing to what you expected to progress, as you said.
Yeah, I love that point. It's something that we've talked about before in the podcast, just the idea of focusing on habits and things that you can control over defining yourself by the results that you see. We had Brian Glick on the podcast a long time ago, and he talked about focusing on process over outcome and finding joy in the performance of doing things and not necessarily what happens out of it, whether you win or lose, because that isn't always something that you can control. I mean, look, there are amazing grapplers out there who we would expect to win in a lot of situations, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes stuff happens. People have to pull out of a fight. People get injured. Someone makes a big mistake. They underestimate their opponent. If you define yourself by the outcomes that you get, you're really setting yourself up for misery. It's just a matter of when, because no one wins all the time. And the question is, are you going to disappoint yourself now or later in the future? Whereas if you define yourself and your goals by intrinsic things, those are things within your control, gives you a feeling of agency. It makes it easier to feel like you're actually accomplishing something. So yeah, I agree with you. When I go into training, my preference, I used to set goals like, I'm going to sweep John today. Fuck John. He always gives me a hard roll. I'm going to sweep that asshole today. I don't do that anymore because I can't control that, right? I mean, look, I can't even control if John's going to show up to class. Nothing worse than setting a goal like that, and then you find out John's on vacation and turns out he was living rent-free in your head this whole time and he didn't even know about
yes.
it. Yes. So now I try to set goals like, okay, I feel like my single leg X is weak. So I'm going to try to make sure that whenever the opportunity arises, I'm going to intentionally try to get to single leg X. And here's some things I want to try from that position, because I can feel good about that. Then it's not so much about whether I succeeded or failed. It's more about, did I put in the reps? Did I execute the plan? Because I know if I do that enough, it's going to make me better eventually anyway.
Yes, it's the execution. So what you were talking about with Brian Glick and process versus outcome, that is also related to the task and ego orientation in terms of the process is those tasks. And if you focus on the actual process and doing everything you can well, like instead of if I was going to punch someone in the face, if my only determination that I'm doing anything is just the damage that it creates on that person's face, then I may not actually be putting out great technique and I won't be actually putting out great power or even accuracy. But if I focus on the direction of my punch, the power, the way that my shoulders rotate, the way that, you know, the angle that I posit my fist into their face, that's going to be much more effective. And then the outcome will then become a consequence. I always say that success and, you know, confidence are consequence of doing the right process. So if you do it step by step, it doesn't necessarily mean that it will always have the outcome that you desire. but you're more likely to. And amongst that, yes, the controllable versus the uncontrollable. And what you mentioned also, so there's this guy Nichols who came up with, well, his understanding was the achievement goal theory. And that was about people who approach those tasks with different type of goal, depending on how they're evaluating themselves, then that's how they can determine success. So a lot of times people say, I want to be this. I'm like, okay, you want to be a world champion? Cool. All right. Let's say you wake up tomorrow. You're a world champion. What does that look like? What do you eat for breakfast? What time do you wake up? Who do you hang out with? What do you do during the day? How do you spend your time? What does that look like? But things that are less measurable, things like, I want to be more confident. Okay, how do you measure that? Yes, you can use assessments. You know, you can quantify the data, but you have to know what that looks like. Because oftentimes you do increase your confidence, but you've minimized it, or you just let it pass without achieving, without celebrating that small achievement. And so it's about those small wins and determining your own level of success, which is so freaking hard. If I were to tell Cobrina when I was a brown belt that I just wanted to go out there and have fun, he probably would be like, that's great, but what about winning? You know, I've had some really hardcore coaches in MMA, you know, where if I were to laugh, they'd be like, what the fuck is so funny? Like, God forbid I enjoy myself and there's play involved. And so making sure that you're also figuring out what your success is, but if it coincides with your environment, that's where it becomes really difficult. And that's why I do want to work with coaches, because those environments, there's such thing as a task or outcome or ego-oriented environment. So if your coach, every time you go to roll, your coach is like, okay, make sure we focus on winning, or you always do King of the Hill. And there's that walk of shame because you never even got to do the bottom position because you can't pass the guard because there's other people that are really a lot better than you, or whatever it is. If there's too much emphasis on results and winning over progress and process, then it makes it very hard for someone in that environment to maintain their own level of success because there's such a disagreement. And oftentimes with the expectations, people will, I guess, they interpret certain things as expectations. So it could be, hey, man, you're going to do so well at that tournament. You're going to awesome. And they're just trying to be supportive. But now you might think, oh, fuck, now I got to be awesome. And if I'm not awesome, then I've let that person down. And so what we determine as success and marks of our own progress is more important. The interpretation of them is more important than the actual result. And the results essentially will come and they might not. You can have, one of the things I like to say is, you can have your best performance and still not win. And you can win and not have your best performance.
Yeah, that's a great insight. I'm one of those people who tends to beat myself up about my performance and my results as well. And I know that it's not a productive thing to do, but it's hard not to, right? As you know, that's why people like you are so valuable. I saw a post on social the other day, which said something to the effect of, a lot of people think that the real power flex is driving an expensive car. But honestly, the real power flex is being able to take a nap whenever you want. And I thought, fuck, that's right. You know, that's completely right. I mean, if I had all the money in the world and I could do everything that I wanted, would I change the way that I live my life on a day-to-day basis? Probably not. I mean, I'd probably stick to the same routine I do now. And that kind of tells me that I actually have abundance. I have everything that I want, and I'm beating myself up for artificial goals that won't actually make me happier, right? I think that's an important thing. It does get lost in jiu-jitsu a lot. Now, there is the old jiu-jitsu adage, keep it playful. There's a lot of things that we can criticize jiu-jitsu about, but honestly, the idea of keeping it playful, where I'm at now in my journey here, I kind of think that that might be the single most important factor for long-term jiu-jitsu success, is to have a mindset of keeping it playful. I have also had situations like the one you described where I'm in the middle of a role and I'm talking or I'm asking questions or I'm trying to have fun and the other person's like, shut up, we don't do that while we're training, we're here to fight. And I mean, look, that shit ain't gonna work. You think that you're making people tough and you think you're creating winners by being serious all the time, but there's increasing reason to believe that that is just not the key to good performance. We've talked a lot on this podcast recently about some of the big changes that we're seeing coaches deploy in jiu-jitsu, kind of of a move more towards game-based training and away from actual fighting and sparring and more towards things that ultimately are there to keep things fun and engaging and simple. And I love this approach because it's less about who wins and loses. You're not looking at your training partner as an opponent or an enemy that you must defeat, but rather they are a collaborator in your training. Great examples of this include Josh McKinney. He's been on the podcast. He's got this idea he calls designated winner. And basically the idea is you roll kind of like it's a pro wrestling match. The outcome is fixed. It's already scripted, but the actual fight is real. You know, you're in there and you're doing your best, but both you and your training partner have a shared objective. And that might be today, the objective is to help Steve get a Delahiva sweep, right? Maybe that's the goal today. And my partner is not there to shut me down. They're there to put up sufficient resistance to make the inevitable win that I have worthwhile. And if the important distinction there is under designated winner, if I don't pull it off, then we both lose, right? If we're supposed to do a Delahiva sweep, and that's the goal, is Steve does a Delahiva sweep, and my training partner just sandbags and deadweights me and won't let it happen, then he or she loses just as much as I do because we had a shared objective. I love that mindset. You know, Rob Bernacki has talked a lot about games-based training as well and the importance of creating games that put yourself in very challenging situations. And I've started doing this and I love this approach. I mean, I said this recently on another podcast. The other day, I got tapped out in the gym by a white belt and it was awesome. It was awesome. You know, me many years ago, I probably would have thought, well, time to turn my black belt in. I just don't deserve this shit. But what I did was I did a what Rob Bernacki calls fuck your jujitsu, which is basically you put yourself in the most difficult situation possible. And the goal is to basically say to the other person, fuck your jujitsu. Like, I am going to put myself in just an impossible situation to give you every advantage possible, and I am going to practice getting out of this. So I went with a white belt. I let them put me in a fully locked in omoplata with my belly on the mat. I tried to get out, couldn't do it, had to tap. But I learned something. So did they, right? I mean, these are great ways to take the ego out of jujitsu and help people understand this isn't me versus them fighting. We are collaborators trying to develop skill together. And I think that, again, this whole mentality of keeping it playful, games-based training, I think this is going to be a big thing in jujitsu for not just making people better, but also improving quality of life for so many grapplers.
Absolutely. I think when you take out the picture of whether you've won or you've lost and that definition of success, when you're changing it, that's when you have a collective. And that's that collective definition. It requires people to, and this is kind of what we were talking about beforehand, which was having jiu-jitsu get to the big stage, so to speak. It had to be a lot of collaboration in the sense of we'd have to agree on one rule set. We'd have to have a certain promotion that we all are supporting. And that's just not the case because it's always, oh, this rule set's better. And no, my tournament's better. And there's a lot of superiority and inferiority happening. And this idea of that designated winner, letting others win. Well, the only issue I have with that is if you're a competitor, whether you're a competitor or not, I guess, you're still going to train that way. But especially if you're a competitor, the interesting aspect or different aspect about jiu-jitsu is that you train together, but you fight alone. And so if you want to develop that perseverance, it's being able to do something despite what the other person is doing. So I've actually taken a different approach in my classes. I've actually given people objectives and they don't know what the other person's objective is, but that person has an objective. Oftentimes when someone goes to roll, they're waiting for someone to do something. They're waiting to see what guard is being set up so they know what to pass with, or they're waiting for someone to pass so they can figure out how they want to sweep them. And so if I separate the people and I have, okay, all the guard players on the side, all the guard passers on the other side, I would go and whisper in their ear just a pass or guard that I wanted them to do. And what's interesting about it, I say interesting a lot because I think it's my favorite word, but it's the people that ended up getting to their actual positions, got there not because they knew that position well. This would be even white belts against brown belts. It's that they had an objective and they knew exactly what they wanted to do. So to me, having an objective in general is great. But when you say that there's a shared objective, now you're going off of interpersonal skills. And arguably, many of the issues that I have had in my training has been interpersonal issues. has been getting along with other people, has been trying to find a shared goal or a shared objective with people. And oftentimes the only objective that is shared is intensity or the goal of winning a tournament, really, and figuring out what it takes to get there and what drills and what things to game plan. And so there is a level of interpersonal success that happens on the mats, obviously, because you can't do jiu-jitsu alone. We've all tried during the pandemic, but you have to assume that everyone is on the same page and that people are willing to be the nail instead of the hammer. And I think that's also where people go wrong with flow rolling. And a lot of it is acceptance. And why would I want to train acceptance into my perseverance and my roles? There's many ways to go about it. I do like the aspect of the designated winner, but also I will bring up how at Pedego, Heath will have someone in the middle and there's an objective, whether it's a sweep or, you know, getting to the back or escaping the back. And whether or not you win or you lose, the person always stays. So essentially, you are the designated person and that person will always stay in the middle and you might have success and then get totally demolished by the next person and then even get demolished again and again. But it teaches you that failure is not the end all, that failure is actually part of learning. And your relationship with failure is your relationship with mistakes and how to take those mistakes and fix them for the future. And anytime that you are challenged, it is actually giving you a highlight into what you should work on. A lot of people go, I don't like having too much challenge. And of course, there is such a thing, but being challenged by someone while obviously not full resistance, if the person is trying to learn something, is really important because jiu-jitsu is essentially not just, yeah, we can be playful, but it is a case of subduing someone and getting them to submit. Like, we can't forget that was the kind of agreed upon result for most people was, yes, jiu-jitsu equals dominating someone positionally and or submitting them.
I love this idea of a blind training experiment where people go in and they don't know the goal of the other person. I've always wanted to do something like that. And I've even thought about putting together a program to do it because I love the idea of your job is to go in and, I don't know, hit a weight or sweep. And their job is to go in and take your back. I've always thought that would be amazing.
This is what I wanted to make, like a jar or something where people just, like, you know, they pull it out and they go, oh, okay. Like a game of charades or something. But I would just do it where I would go, okay, I'd whisper in their ear, all creepy, and I'd be like, you're gonna play spider guard. And then the other person, I wouldn't even remember what I told that person, what I was telling their opponent, because I didn't go from one person's pass and one person's guard. I just went all the guards and then all the passes. So I didn't even know what I said. I didn't remember what I said. It was so fun to see who was getting it. And it was funny because you'd hear people giggling because all of a sudden, right when they would start, because they would try to get to that position before the other one did, they would go, oh, I see you. You're trying to do knee slice, or, oh, you're trying to get spider guard. And instead of anticipating what they were going to do, they didn't really care because they had their own objective. And so when you go with someone who actually has an objective, it's a lot harder to roll with them because they're not just waiting for things to happen. They're making things happen.
Yeah. Well, Aaron, if someone were to sign up for a program like this, if they'd identified that they want to improve their mental toughness, they agree with the definitions that you've put out here today, if this message resonated with them, what should they expect out of that? If someone signs up with you, sits down for the first session with you, what does the program look like and what would they experience?
Oftentimes, I will start with a values. I work under the acceptance and commitment training, which is accepting that things are going to be hard, accepting that there is going to be a struggle and not avoiding it, and then moving in a way that commits within your values. So committing to actions that are important for your values. So my values are authenticity, vulnerability, and self-confidence. And they will change. Values are fluid. So we would choose, okay, if vulnerability is one of my values, then yeah, any opportunity I have to potentially fail, but also to potentially find more about myself, yeah, I'm going to do that. And then authenticity says, I'm not going to act like I'm this hoity-toity professional because I am a professional, but I am not the person that is a corporate professional. I'm not the person that says, I'm going to hide my tattoos and I'm going to make sure that I look the same way every time I meet someone online. So that's kind of where my values lie. And having someone be able to choose their values helps them commit to a success or goal that is in line with what they are searching for as just a human and what they value. And then we would go into different assessments. Whether you come to me with anxiety, I might use the state or trade anxiety questionnaire. I might use the sport mental toughness questionnaire. I might go through sources of confidence, or I might even just do the mental skills inventory just to see kind of where you're at and what you know already about goal setting, imagery, self-talk, and whatnot. And then we kind of go into, all right, let's monitor your self-talk. Why don't you do a self-talk log and then write down the things that you are saying to yourself and the ways that they come up and what triggers them. So if you're rolling with someone really good and they're frustrating you, it's like, oh, I fucking suck. But that's really important for me to understand because it's spontaneous self-talk that is highlighting what I'm going to be working with you. Like, I want to know exactly what you're thinking in the moment. Then there's arousal management, where it might look like figuring out, well, what does it look like? What are the physiological signs that show up when you are stressed? And then we go into maybe the stress theory with the primary and secondary appraisals. And I kind of bring in that idea of, well, every time that you get stressed, you're actually just appraising it as, I don't have the resources to meet these demands. So let's break it down. What are the demands? I might go into some of the fears that they have. All right, let's play it out. So let's say you're teaching. Is someone going to really go, you fucking suck, you know, like from the back? Like, is that realistic? Probably not, you know, go through that. I also do actual exercises like the individual zone of functioning, where we pick the actual emotions that you would like to have help you, and then the ones that are hindering your performance. And then obviously how to aim towards those, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. If they're helpful, then that's more important. Also, I do a performance wheel where we decide 12 different qualities and traits that it will take to be successful at jujitsu or whatever sport you have or the performance that you're having. And then ranking those in importance and then rating yourself. So it's just a lot of internal work and deciding what your individual definitions are and how you interpret things. And so every session that I do is just getting into the reality in the mind of my client. And it's mostly talking, but sometimes we do the activities. But it's definitely a program where I can't tell you we're going to do this, 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 because it depends on your individual needs. So I have what's called a chemistry call. So I do a free 30-minute call just to decide if I do have the competencies to help someone and what they're looking for. And we go from there. And I don't actually have set programs in the sense where I say, okay, 6 weeks, we're going to do this, this, this. Because like I said, it's going to be personalized. It's going to change for everyone. So I try to keep it really customized. And it's in a format in the sense that I am always working with where the athlete is and meeting them where they are.
That sounds amazing. Now, if people want to reach out to you and maybe book one of these sessions and get going, how do they go about doing that?
You can go to my website, erinhurley.com. I also have Instagram called Train Your Mind, which is my coaching business. And right now I have a quiz out there that is to see how mentally tough you are, which is the data that we were talking about earlier.
Amazing. Well, I will do what I always do. I will put all of those links in the show notes just to make it easy for people to click through. So if you want to go to Erin's website, contact her, learn more about Train Your Mind, or take this mental toughness quiz as well. I'll put all of that stuff there. But one other thing I always want to make sure I plug when I talk to you, Erin, submit the stigma. We should talk about this one more time. It's been a while since we've discussed this here on the podcast. What's that all about?
Yeah, Submit the Stigma is a mental health advocacy campaign and nonprofit that focuses on normalizing mental health issues in the jiu-jitsu community. We have a Mental Health Conscious Academy program where you can learn how to speak non-judgmentally to people that may be struggling and how to deal with those difficult conversations via role-playing. And you get a certification afterwards. And we also have more resources on the website for where to find help. Obviously, mental health is a very, very important aspect of everyone's lives. But when my dad died by suicide and, you know, I dealt with my, or I still deal with my own mental health issues, I realized how much jiu-jitsu does help and how therapeutic it is. But I also like to get the word out that jiu-jitsu itself is not therapy. The people that you roll with are not your therapist. Your coach is not your therapist. These people are not your punching bags. It is not the place that you go to let off all of your steam. I always tell people, seek help mental performance consultants. If you are not struggling with mental health issues, but want to increase your well-being and your performance, otherwise a mental health professional like a therapist or a psychologist or a psychiatrist who can give you the right information and guidance on how to feel and act better.
Amazing. Well, again, I will throw a link to Submit the Stigma in the show notes as well. I don't want to dox anyone, but I can tell you, Aaron, that some people within the BJJ Mental Models community do actually work under your mental health coaching program, and they all say amazing things about it. I mean, of course, I endorse your work greatly. So if anyone is looking for what we've discussed here on the show, if this fills a niche here, if it fills a gap that you're dealing with, just check the show notes. There will be links to all of Aaron's stuff there. I'll also throw a link to our stuff. Everything we make lives at bjjmentalmodels.com. Over 260 something episodes now of evergreen content that, yeah, I know that's quite a lot, that I think all of you are going to enjoy if you haven't listened to it already. It's all free, so go check it out. You can also get our newsletter there, which again, I highly recommend. Also free, you can unsubscribe at any time. Beyond that, check out BJJ Mental Models Premium at the same site. That's how we pay the bills here. Premium subscribers get access to our entire course library featuring insights on jiu-jitsu strategy, tactics, mindset, concepts, really from some of the best minds and coaches in the sport. I think probably going into 2024, I'm going to make sure we have a specific focus on mindset, confidence, mental health, mental toughness there as well. I think that audio is such a great medium for communicating this stuff. And I think that this is something that almost every grappler out there benefits from, regardless of what walk of life they come in here from. You also get direct coaching from our review team. So you can send us your videos. We'll break it down and give you detailed feedback. Again, like we talked about earlier on the podcast, at most gyms, your coach, no matter how good they are, they're simply not going to have the bandwidth to provide this level of technical detail to everyone. So if you want a multi-time black belt world champ to spend 30 minutes breaking down exactly how bad you suck and how you can get better, this is, as far as I know, the best place in the world to do that. So again, all of that's at bjjmentalmodels.com. I do appreciate everyone checking that out. And I appreciate you coming by, Aaron. I always love these chats. I love the work that you're doing. I can't thank you enough for trying to dispel some of the stigmas around mental health in a sport that is kind of, for better or worse, ruggedly individual. I think it's great that you're adding nuance to this definition of toughness. And I hope this is something that benefited everyone out there as much as it benefited me. So thank you again.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me and giving me a platform to share all of this knowledge and, you know, to open up opportunities for me as a mental performance consultant.
No worries. You are always welcome here. Same to the listeners as well. Thank you so much for coming by, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care.